Welcome back to The Europeans, the podcast that every week tries to tame the wild beast that is European politics and make it vaguely understandable. This is Katie speaking to you from a very wet Paris, and I'm talking to my charming co-host over there in Amsterdam. How are you doing, Dominic?
Hey, that's a very nice introduction. Are you feeling in a good mood today?
Well, last week you did an interview-themed intro in that you made it food-based because we had a food-based interview. And this week we have a wild beast-themed interview.
See what I did? More on that later. Yes, I do. Did you have a nice Europe day last week?
I have to confess, this year I didn't do anything specifically Europe-related on Europe Day. I feel like a very bad European. What did you do?
Well, producer Katz and I went for a reception at the offices of the European Cultural Foundation.
Oh, yeah.
Where their director, Andre, called for Europe Day to become a national holiday across the EU.
Yes.
Now, he said this before, and at first I thought it was a bit gimmicky, but I'm really coming around to the idea. Wouldn't it be nice if like one of our bank holidays was connected to celebrating peace in Europe and unity instead of just another Christian festival day?
And it would be nice if you had to make a sort of European banquet to eat, or like eat food from neighbouring countries or something like that.
Yes, I love it. And I should actually mention that it's already a national holiday in Kosovo and Luxembourg. So well done, Kosovo and Luxembourg. Let's make it happen across the continent.
Let's do it. So back on the subject of wild beasts.
Yes, this week we're going to be discussing one of the big dilemmas of our time in Europe. How to live alongside the wolves. The protection of these apex predators has become a very thorny political issue in recent years. We're going to be speaking to an expert today, someone who has studied how wolves and humans can coexist and some of the problems there. That person is Hannah Pettersson. She'll be joining us later on in the show. But first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Who's had a bad week, Dominic?
Katie, I'm afraid I'm going to flagrantly break your prohibition on discussing the Eurovision Song Contest. And I'm going to give bad week to Eurovision organisers, the European Broadcasting Union, which I will refer to here on as the EBU because it's a bit of a mouthful. Mm-hmm. They're getting bad week after they ran possibly the most chaotic, divisive and controversial Eurovision Song Contest in the competition's history.
I mean, this is the first year in a really long time that I didn't actually watch Eurovision. I had family visiting, and also the voting finishes like way past my bedtime now that I'm a parent. But I sort of followed it a bit online and it looked like absolute chaos. So I'm glad that you're here to break the whole thing down for me.
Yeah, the 24 hours before the grand finale of the competition were completely mad. I don't think I've been so glued to Twitter since the last US presidential election. And honestly, I don't really know where to start because so much happened in Malmö, and I'm definitely not going to be able to discuss all the ins and outs of all the happenings in the next few minutes. But I thought maybe I should start by giving you an idea of the level of anger that is being directed at the organisers, the EBU. Here's a quote from the singer representing Ireland this year, an artist called Bambi Thug, who achieved a very respectable sixth place in the competition with their bewitching number Doomsday Blue. After the competition, Bambi Thug said the following to reporters, and please excuse my language. They said, "It has been so hard and so horrible, and I'm so proud of us. And I just want to say, we are what the Eurovision is. The EBU is not what Eurovision is. Fuck the EBU. I don't even care anymore. Fuck them. The thing that makes this is the contestants."
Wow. That's quite some anger.
It really is. And Bambi is by no means the only angry artist. For example, the Lithuanian entrant put out a statement saying he wished he hadn't taken part in the final altogether. Bambi was one of two non-binary artists performing in the contest this year, and the other non-binary artist was Nemo, the Swiss entrant who went on to win the competition with their song about discovering their identity called The Code. They actually beat bookmakers' favourite Croatia to take the trophy. Little sidebar, this is the first time the bookies got it wrong since 2018, which I was quite pleased about.
Well, there you are.
And actually, a funny thing happened with the trophy itself. Nemo was handed it and it almost immediately broke in two in the most perfect metaphor for all the chaos and anger at this year's song contest.
Oh no!
The competition slogan is United by Music, but I think Disunited by Music is probably more appropriate.
So it feels like there were, like, I don't know, 15 mini scandals around the competition this year, but one of them was about the Dutch contestant who got disqualified at the last minute. And I was wondering, is that why you're giving the EBU bad week? Because I know you're actually quite a fan of the Dutch entry, or at least the message behind it, if not the song.
Well, I am, of course, staying neutral in this case, whilst the investigation around the Dutch contestant is ongoing.
Very good.
Although, yes, this is one of the dramatic and controversial things that happened, so we can start here. If you didn't hear about it, Joost Klein, the Dutch entrant, was one of the favourites. He had this song, Europapa, which was an ode to the European Union and the wonders of borderless travel. At the same time, it was an ode to his parents, who both very sadly died when he was a child. It was his lifelong dream to perform at Eurovision, and he did get to perform in the semi-final, but he was dramatically disqualified just a few hours before he was due to perform in the grand final due to an alleged incident that happened after he performed in the semi-final that involved a, quote, threatening movement towards a camera woman after he had apparently repeatedly asked her not to film him. This incident led to a police investigation into, quote, unlawful threats. And following that investigation, the case has been sent to the prosecutor. It's really difficult to know what happened here. There's very little public information at the time of recording. And it's been striking to see how divided people online are on how the EBU responded to this. The Dutch broadcaster Avrotros and the Dutch commentator of Eurovision, Cornald Maas, backed Joost and said that this disqualification was disproportionate to what happened. On the other hand, many people are saying, believe the woman, even if the story is about a charming pop star that you all like. And a different version of the story has since come out in the Swedish tabloid Aftonbladet that paints Joost in a worse light, saying his threatening movement had actually broken her camera and cut the employee. We don't know what happened, but everyone seems to agree that Joost did react threateningly, and that is obviously bad. However, the Dutch broadcaster, and I should say much of the Netherlands, are still backing him. The Dutch broadcaster has even lodged an official complaint against the EBU about how the case was handled. So yeah, that's one of the things that caused a huge amount of drama around last weekend's competition and one of the many complaints sitting on the EBU's in tray.
Okay, what next?
Well, of course, the biggest story and source of controversy at Eurovision this year was around Israel's participation in the contest. The competition is officially apolitical, but for many people, allowing Israel to perform while it's involved in a divisive war with terrible humanitarian consequences is in itself a political choice. In its battle to crush Hamas after the horrific terrorist attack from last October, Israel is being accused of war crimes in Gaza. The UN special rapporteur said that she found reasonable grounds to believe that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. And of course, we shouldn't place the weight of a country's government's decision on the shoulders of a pop star. But if Israel had won the competition, it would have been presented as a political win, a show of solidarity with the state of Israel. And the Israeli government seems to have been very aware of that. There was a huge ad campaign online to drum up votes for Israel. The Israeli consulate general in New York even paid for huge adverts in Times Square to encourage people to vote for Eden Golan, the Israeli artist representing the country.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've never heard of any country going to that kind of extreme to get votes for Eurovision. There were also huge protests in Malmö around the EBU's decision to allow Israel to compete. Greta Thunberg was actually even arrested outside the arena whilst protesting. She seems to be arrested every week these days.
She does. But Israel, I was really surprised to see, actually did pretty well with the public vote, right?
Yeah, in the end, Israel came in second in the televoting, but they actually ended lower in the final result, in fifth place due to lower points from the jury. Some people have been trying to present this strong public vote for Israel as a sign that Europeans support the actions of the Israeli government. And of course, some people do. But this vote does not mean that a majority of Europeans support the actions of the Israeli government. It's worth noting that in this kind of vote, when you decide to vote for a country and can vote up to 20 times, you can have a motivated minority deciding to vote for one country as a show of solidarity, and that can have a big effect on the results.
Mm.
I was sent a great piece of analysis by one of our listeners with comments from an Irish pollster, looking at how it was that Ireland ended up giving the second most points to Israel, despite Ireland being a country that is very critical of the actions of Israel. I'll share the link in the notes if you're interested. But yeah, however hard the EBU try, the Eurovision Song Contest is not just about music, just as it wasn't just about music when Ukraine won the competition soon after Putin began Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. There was almost certainly an element of solidarity in the public voting for Ukraine that year, although I actually think it was a great song too.
It was.
And it was also the year that Russia was banned from the competition following that invasion.
I saw something on social media about members of the Israeli delegation and the Israeli press getting some complaints as well. What was that all about?
Yeah, there have been some complaints made about the behaviour of members of the Israeli delegation, and specifically about a commentator from the Israeli broadcaster Kan. Ireland's Bambi Thug said that they raised multiple complaints about things the commentator had said on air to the EBU, and that according to them, the EBU acknowledged there were multiple breaches of the rules. The Portuguese broadcaster has also reported witnessing the Israeli team harassing members of other delegations. It all basically sounds like a horrible atmosphere backstage. Mm. And it's the first year that I'm actually not envious of people who got to attend in person.
Yeah.
The Portuguese broadcaster have also lodged a formal complaint to the EBU due to an odd thing that happened where the grand finale performance of the Portuguese act wasn't uploaded onto YouTube immediately, unlike for the other acts. There's a suspicion that it was because the Portuguese performer had painted her nails in colours that showed solidarity with the people of Palestine.
Oh God, of course there was going to be a nail art scandal as part of this drama.
The Portuguese team also want to know if fake applause and cheering from the crowd was played in the broadcast when Israel was performing. It's particularly striking to see the clips people filmed in the stadium itself and how much booing there was when Eden Golan was performing. We know that Eurovision have used anti-booing technology in the past. They admitted to using it in 2015 when Russia was being booed. And there's a suspicion that this happened again this year when Israel was performing.
Anti-booing technology? Is that a thing?
Yeah, it is, apparently. And I guess the idea is to make it less political so the audience at home can't hear if the audience in the arena are making a political statement by booing a specific country.
Wow, that is so weird. I had no idea you could do that. And I have to say, like, as a journalist, I find it quite unsettling. It's like, it's literally creating a different version of reality to what actually happened in the room to present it differently to people watching on TV.
Yeah, it's definitely questionable and controversial. And I also find it a bit weird that the EBU has, up until now, at the point of recording, denied that they used that technology this year. From the footage I've seen from the arena, it seemed pretty clear to me that the technology was being used. That aside, many people think that booing this young woman, Eden Golan, was cruel and not fair, and lots of people have been showing sympathy online for her. Although I was actually talking to a sound technician randomly at work the other day whilst I was getting my microphone put on, and he pointed out she was wearing in-ears, which means she won't have heard any of the booing. Mm. So maybe it's fine. Also, some people say that performing and being booed just unfortunately comes with the territory when you're representing a state involved in such a brutal war.
Mm. But in general, it sounds like the EBU are going to be dealing for ages with like loads of fallout from this event.
Yeah, and there are various countries that have said they are going to have to look at whether they want to compete next year. So things are really bad. And I think a lot of the fallout is because the EBU were doing absolutely everything they could to try and stop the competition from having any political symbols or statements. One of the things I have yet to mention that the EBU did was the banning of flags apart from flags that were for countries performing, plus rainbow pride flags. They were also allowed. Apparently, this rule has been in place for a year already, although it sounds like it wasn't actually enforced properly last year. But this year, it was taken to rather ridiculous extremes when they confiscated any European flags brought into the stadium. That's the flag that's used by the EU, as in the blue one with yellow stars on it. Mm-hmm. I found it quite striking to hear that the Eurovision Song Contest had banned European flags from their audience. And it has really not gone down well with the top politicians of the European Union. There is a European election coming up in 3 weeks, lest you forget. And it's a pretty weird message to say to Europeans that they cannot show their celebration of European togetherness with a flag at a song competition that's about uniting around music.
Right.
And as friend of the pod, Alexander Brezza, pointed out on Twitter, the flag is actually not an EU flag officially. It's the European flag. It's used by the EU, but also by the much broader club of the Council of Europe. It was actually first designed for the Council of Europe and only later adopted by the EU. It's a little interesting piece of history, flag history for you all.
I actually didn't know that.
I think it was a particularly jarring decision from the EBU, considering that on the same night, record numbers of Georgians were taking to the streets in Tbilisi, carrying these European flags, protesting against the passing of a Kremlin-style foreign ownership bill. Katie talked about it on the show last week. I saw that Politico reporters have asked the EBU if Georgia's government-controlled broadcaster, a member of the EBU, placed any pressure on the EBU to ban the flags from the stadium, which would be a big scandal if that was the case. But Politico hadn't received an answer when publishing, so I'll be keeping an eye on that one. Anyway, Flaggate, as I've decided to call it, made its way right up to the top of the European Commission, with President von der Leyen's office even putting out a statement that is very critical of the flag decision. The Greek European Commissioner, Margaritis Schinas, was particularly angry about the decision. He said it was mind-blowing that he would be seeking explanation and clarification and that he will not let this pass.
Just to be clear, the EBU, the Broadcasting Union, it's not actually part of the EU, is it?
No, it's not part of the EU. It's an alliance of public service media organisations that's based in Geneva, and the member countries are much broader than just EU countries. It even includes some authoritarian states like Azerbaijan. It's probably quite a difficult club to keep together, I imagine. And in fact, both the broadcasters of Belarus and Russia were indefinitely suspended over the past 5 years because they were determined to have become too much of a mouthpiece for their respective regimes. So the EBU is definitely not part of the EU, but the EBU does sometimes work with the EU. For example, they're meant to be hosting the Eurovision debate on the 23rd of May, a big debate in the run-up to the European elections, where all the lead candidates of the European party groupings come together. But Schinas, this Greek EU commissioner, said to Politico that whether or not that debate goes forward will depend on the explanations that are given around this flag scandal. He said about the flag decision that for the time being, no one has bothered to tell us why. So overall, I think it's pretty clear that it's been a bad week for the EBU. Mm-hmm. This year's Eurovision really doesn't seem to have brought Europeans closer together. In fact, it seems to have had quite the opposite effect. And perhaps the EBU don't deserve all the blame, as our producer Wojciech pointed out to me the other day. Isn't this just the zeitgeist we're in, where even the most lighthearted camp fun night of the year has to become a depressing existential nightmare?
That's the spirit.
I do wonder what the EBU will learn from this and how they will pick up the pieces, and if Martin Ostendahl, the Eurovision boss, and all the EBU executives will stay in their jobs. Anyway, I will leave you with the words of Nemo, this year's extremely talented winner, who was speaking in their winner's press conference about the fact that they had had to smuggle in their own flag, the non-binary flag, into the competition because it wasn't allowed.
This is clearly like a double standard. And as I say, like, I broke the code and I broke the trophy. Maybe the trophy can be fixed. Maybe Eurovision needs a little bit of fixing too every now and then.
You know, it's funny. I didn't actually watch the competition this year, but some of my family did. And from the chat on our family WhatsApp group, you would have no idea that Eurovision was any different from normal. Like, it was all about like, oh, which songs are good, which songs are really bad, which of the outfits that the singers are wearing were particularly insane. Like, you really had to be following all of this online to have any idea how chaotic it really was.
Yeah, and I guess to that end, I guess maybe the Eurovision organizers did the best job they could to try and hide this from the public. Whether or not that was the right thing to do, I don't know. I know lots of people in the Netherlands found it really weird that there was absolutely no mention of the fact that Joost Klein had been disqualified. It just was like the elephant in the room for the people that knew. But in a way, it's nice to hear that some people can carry on enjoying it without any of the bullshit.
I guess we have to look on the bright side.
I guess we do. Who's had a good week, Katie?
Well, I think the Spanish Socialist Party have had a pretty great week. They came top in last weekend's regional elections in Catalonia, winning 42 out of the 135 seats in the regional parliament. So not a majority, but it's enough seats to mean that the parties that support an independent Catalonia, separate as a country from the rest of Spain, those parties no longer have the majority in parliament that they would need to stay in power in the region.
Wow.
And that's a really big deal. Like, these parties have been in power in Catalonia for a decade.
It's obviously a hugely complicated and emotive issue, Catalan independence. But for people that haven't necessarily followed all the drama of recent years, can you give us a quick recap? There was a referendum on whether Catalonia should break away from the rest of Spain a few years ago, right?
Yes. So that referendum was back in 2017. It was organized by the pro-independence Catalan parties that were running the regional government at the time. And it was a really fraught time. I helped to cover the aftermath of that vote in Madrid, and the whole thing was completely mad. It was the biggest political crisis of recent Spanish history. The referendum was not an authorized one. The Spanish government in Madrid was very against it, and actually the Constitutional Court also said that it would be unlawful. But the regional government went ahead with it anyway, and the day itself saw a lot of ugliness. The Spanish police came in and tried to shut the vote down, in some cases very violently. They beat election workers and voters. And in the end, less than half of Catalonia's population actually voted. Some of them stayed away because they thought this referendum was illegitimate and better off ignored. Others because the police stopped them from voting. But ultimately, the lack of voters meant that the people who did cast the ballot were overwhelmingly pro-independence. 90% of them voted to break away from Spain. And a few weeks afterwards, the Catalan leader at the time, Carlos Puigdemont, he actually declared independence from Spain. Very briefly. He then quickly suspended the Declaration of Independence, which added loads more confusion to an already confusing situation. And after that, things got even messier and uglier. The Spanish government fired the Catalan regional government and took away its powers. And that was really controversial in a region that, under the Franco dictatorship, had really had its separate identity suppressed, and so was fiercely protective of the significant autonomy that it has had more recently over its own affairs. A bunch of Catalan political leaders were jailed over this referendum. And as for Puigdemont, the main separatist leader, he fled the country, and he's been gone ever since. He moved to Brussels, he got elected to the European Parliament. More recently, he's been based out of the south of France. And he kind of became a cult figure for supporters of Catalan independence, this kind of romantic exiled leader. But he's been living under the threat of being arrested if he ever set foot in Spain again.
But that situation has changed now, right?
It's about to. And that is because of what happened in Spain's national elections in July last year. Pedro Sanchez, Spain's prime minister, he ended up in a really awkward situation after those elections. He was desperately trying to find a workable government. And he ended up turning to Puigdemont, this firebrand separatist. And he basically said to him, you know, your party have just won 7 seats in the national parliament. What can I give you in exchange for them supporting my government? And Puigdemont says, I want all of the charges dropped against myself and everyone else who got imprisoned or charged over the referendum. I want an amnesty. And Sanchez had no choice but to say, okay, fine, I'll give you what you want. I mean, to be fair, he'd already been trying a more conciliatory approach towards the separatists. He had pardoned already the politicians who'd been put behind bars over the referendum. But this amnesty deal would allow Puigdemont himself to finally come home as a free man. And that was a pretty humiliating thing for the Spanish government to accept after years of trying to extradite him. But it was ultimately a price that Sanchez was willing to pay so that he could actually form a government.
And now Sanchez and his socialists have won these elections in Catalonia. What are we supposed to make of that?
Well, I think we have to see it as a pretty good vindication of Sanchez's approach towards the separatists. Like, Spain's great political gambler has done it again. He's such an interesting figure, Sanchez. This offer of an amnesty, it was super unpopular when it was announced back in November. There were huge protests against it by Spanish citizens who are against the separatists. But these elections in Catalonia kind of show why this was a clever strategy for Sanchez. Because ultimately, it's reduced separatism to a much smaller political issue. Since the government in Madrid has been relatively nice to the separatists lately, a lot of Catalan voters voted last weekend with more daily issues in mind. And the socialist leader in Catalonia, Salvador Illa, he ran a campaign focused on, you know, wanting to improve public services, wanting to deal with this terrible drought that's been affecting Catalonia this year. And it really seems like that spoke to a lot of listeners, although it also seems like a lot of people also just fancy a change after 10 years of the separatists being in power. Mm. Having said that, Puigdemont's party did actually come in a pretty close second behind the socialists. So I don't want to make it sound like the pro-independence movement is completely dead. It still has a lot of support.
Yeah, that's actually something I wanted to ask. How much support is there these days for an independent Catalan state? Do we know?
Yeah, it's something that's always been really divisive in Catalonia. There has always been a big chunk of the population that believes Catalonia should be part of Spain, and another big chunk that feels very passionately that Catalonia would be better off as a separate country, and not only for reasons of identity and language, but sometimes also economic arguments. Catalonia is one of Spain's richest regions, and in the years after the financial crisis especially, more people started thinking they'd be better off going it alone. It's still very divisive, but the separatists do seem to have lost some of their momentum in recent years. There was a study by the regional government's own polling agency that showed in February that 51.1% of Catalans support unity with Spain, compared to 44.1% in 2019. So a little bit more than a few years ago.
And you said that the socialists didn't actually win a majority in these elections, even if they came top. Mm-hmm. Are they definitely going to be able to take power over the regional government in Catalonia?
That's the big question. You need 68 seats to get a majority in the Catalan parliament, and socialists only have 42. Mm. So they're going to have to find some friends to team up with. It seems like they might just be able to scrape 68 seats if they team up with a party further to the left than the socialists, called Comuns, as well as the Catalan Republican Left Party, who do actually support independence. But if the socialists don't manage to scrape a deal together, here's the interesting thing. Carlos Puigdemont, the separatist who came in second, he might actually have a shot at being president of Catalonia again. Technically, he said that if he lost this election, he would just retire and enjoy spending some time actually living with his family again, now that he's very soon going to be allowed back into the country. And it's hard to see what kind of a government Puigdemont could actually form, given that the pro-independence parties don't actually have enough seats between them for a majority. But you never know. You have to remember that Puigdemont holds a lot of power over Spain's national government right now. So you can imagine this crazy situation where he, like, I don't know, like maybe orders the MPs from his party to stop working with Sanchez's national government if he's not allowed to be president of Catalonia or something like that. I honestly think Spanish politics is so interesting right now. Like, for nerds like us, it is really one of the most interesting countries in Europe to be kind of following along with popcorn. And actually, I just want to add, before I wrap this up, if you do want to follow all of this drama, there is no better person to follow on Twitter than friend of the show, Aitor Hernandez Morales, Politico's correspondent covering Spain and Portugal. His tweet threads are so good. I will post the one that he did about these elections in the show notes.
It's that time in the show where we like to thank the lovely people who have decided to support us on Patreon because they value what we do here. Thank you all so much. This week we have two new supporters to thank, Yonken and Barati.
Thank you guys. I know everyone gets bored of us saying it, but this podcast is entirely reliant on the generosity of its listeners. There is no media mogul funding this thing. Maybe if you are a media mogul, get in touch.
Not if you're Rupert Murdoch.
Not if you're Rupert Murdoch. And actually, we really like just being accountable to our listeners rather than an evil media mogul. So if you would like to keep this show proudly independent, we would love it if you could send any amount of cash that you can afford, big or small, to our Patreon fund, patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Let's talk about wolves. We've been a little bit obsessed with wolves on this podcast for a long time now. We've talked about the rise in Europe's wolf population a couple of times over the years. And this obsession grew significantly 2 years ago when Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, she suffered a personal tragedy involving a wolf. Her family's beloved pony, Dolly, who was 30 years old, was killed by a wolf. And this itself was very sad, but this personal tragedy also seems to have contributed in a very real way to Ursula von der Leyen seeking to change the direction of European policy. She's been pushing since late last year for the protection status of wolves to be downgraded in Europe. Although I should add that Hannah, the expert that we're about to speak to, has cautioned against this narrative of like Europe's most powerful woman against the wolf. This is a conversation that people have been having in Europe for a little while now. Currently, wolves play quite a big role in the EU's biodiversity strategy, but von der Leyen and others in her Conservative Party have started asking whether we actually should be encouraging wolves quite as much as we have been. Because after all, the wolf population has really bounced back after being hunted nearly to extinction in Europe in the 19th century.
How many are there?
They're actually pretty hard to count, but there was an EU report last year that estimated that there are more than 20,000 wolves across the bloc today, which is a more than 80% increase over a decade. And these wolves are eating a lot of sheep and cows.
And ponies.
Wolves attacked more than 65,000 livestock across Europe last year, and farmers have to be compensated for that. What's clear is that as the numbers of wolves grows across Europe, more and more we're having to learn how to live with these predators. And the answer for how to do that really varies from place to place. It's a really fascinating policy question. Someone who has thought more than maybe anyone else about how humans and wolves can and should coexist is the Swedish researcher Hannah Pettersson. We gave her a call at the University of York, where she's currently based in the UK. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the first thing I wanted to ask about in general was this really quite big expansion in Europe's wolf population. They've made a massive comeback over the past decade here in Europe. How much of that is because we've had active policies to encourage it? And how much of this has happened just without humans trying to make it happen?
Inevitably, you get the kind of, it depends in that reply, because there's partly, of course, the laws that have come into place since the wolf became protected, since the regulation connected to the Berne Convention and the Habitat Directive, which are these big European directives and sets of laws that regulate what we can hunt and when we can do it and so on. You can't just go out and shoot a wolf like you could back in the day. And that has definitely helped the recovery of wolves across Europe. But then there are multiple other processes going on in terms of people moving into the cities and there being more space in the countryside and therefore also more species that the wolf can eat in the countryside. So lots of deer, for example, that are expanding everywhere. And also just a change in mindset of a lot of people, more people being keen to protect them. There are many, many different things going on at the same time, which are all helping the wolf, if you will. And it's really taking those opportunities that we have provided it with through all these different intentional or unintentional measures.
For the people who are opposed to the protection of wolves, I think their arguments are rather obvious, particularly for livestock farmers having to deal with the loss of their animals, which is both costly and potentially upsetting. But what are the arguments on the other side? What are the arguments in favor of encouraging these predators to return in bigger numbers to our landscape?
That is also very much dependent on who you ask. And there are many stories about wolves. That's important to begin there, potentially. There are the stories about the wolf as a dangerous predator that might kill and eat both animals and people, right? But there are equally exaggerated stories on the other side that the wolf will come back and the wilderness will return, no trees will be eaten by deer anymore, and everything will be wonderful and balanced, right? But the kind of narratives in favor of wolves coming back are often connected to these ideas of bringing wilderness back, that they will bring these services, these regulating services, which they do. But the question is how much and where, especially in human-dominated landscapes where there are lots of people and sheep and other animals too. And the evidence that is coming out there is very inconclusive. So to kind of begin with, there's a lot of things about wolves returning that we don't yet know how they will impact the landscape and what effect that they will have, which leaves us with this idea of why we want wolves to come back being more about what we want. A lot of people feel very strongly that the wolf has a place in Europe, that it should be there. It was there before, and therefore they should be there now. And that's a completely fine and legitimate feeling to have. But we should be careful about justifying that feeling with particular stories and evidence, which actually doesn't exist, about all the benefits that they will bring. Because there are, for sure, benefits of wolves, but there are also disbenefits, and those will depend a lot, depending on which place you're talking about.
So your work focuses on how humans and wolves can and should coexist. And for your PhD, you studied different areas of Spain, which were approaching the question of this coexistence a little bit differently. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you found?
I was interested in knowing, are there places out there where people and wolves are living together relatively harmoniously? And what can we learn from those places? And can we amplify those? And I did that through several case studies in Spain, because it's a typical country where wolves actually didn't go extinct. They were still there, but they have spread and increased. So we have those cases where people have been living with wolves for a long time, and some places that are kind of well known for coexistence. I was curious to kind of explore what was going on there.
And what were some of the measures that people were using to coexist with wolves in Spain?
In one place where I was working, for example, in Sierra La Culebra, the shepherds, they were shepherding their sheep still, like they were with their sheep all throughout the day. And then they locked them in at night. And then they had these massive livestock guardian dogs. And in the past, they didn't need that many livestock guardian dogs because there were perhaps not that many wolves around. But as the wolf population in these areas have kept growing, they've needed to increase the number of livestock guardian dogs. So these livestock guardian dogs in this particular place worked quite well. In some cases, it was still very complicated. Other people coming through the area, walking their private pet dog, and that causing issues. Tourists coming in and being hunted by these livestock guardian dogs who are trying to guard the livestock. So it's not a simple story of that working perfectly every time, right? But yes, they had quite few losses. But they also had very, very high costs. Because the way the systems work now in terms of support and compensation, only the people who lose sheep will get support. But these people who were doing all this work to prevent their sheep from becoming attacked, they get nothing. And that's, I think, one of the most important findings of my research, is that we really got to change the way we work with coexistence. Rather than going to the places and bringing the wolf back to places who don't want them, we need to start in the areas that have really good conditions for coexistence, but are currently vulnerable to disappearing because of a lack of support.
You just came back a couple of weeks ago from your most recent fieldwork in Sweden. Did you find very different things there than you found in Spain?
Yeah, so I was interested in exploring another type of system where you, instead of paying for the number of livestock that a wolf has killed, you pay according to the number of large carnivores that are in a particular area. So you pay for the presence of the carnivore rather than the damage it produces. Sweden does have this system in the Sami reindeer herding district, which is about half of Sweden's surface. So the Sami communities will be paid every year according to how many large carnivores there are. The practice is a bit complicated, as always, because these types of systems where you pay according to how many carnivores there are very dependent on the monitoring of these carnivores, right? Knowing exactly how many they are and where they are. And that is very difficult. That was very difficult in Spain because monitoring wolves without snow is very difficult. So you have to basically drive around the countryside on endless gravelly, bumpy roads and looking for wolf poop or doing these howling surveys. So the number of wolves in Spain is very uncertain. And there are similar things in Sweden because up north in Sweden, it's in the Arctic Circle where I'm working, there's the tundra and very, very sparsely populated. So what you do is that you drive around on a snowmobile looking for wolverine poop and then analyzing that with DNA and then doing some modeling to kind of try to figure out how many of them you would have found and how many you haven't found. And then using that data to compensate the reindeer herders. And what I've found, which is still very preliminary, is that there's a lot of issues going on here. Partly because there's a disagreement of how many of these wolverines we're actually finding. The second issue being that Sweden, which is one of the richest countries in the world, is not coughing up the right amount. So we have an estimation made in the end of the 90s about how much approximately damage a wolverine is creating. But that amount hasn't been adjusted since then. So the fuel, the price of the reindeer and so on has gone up a lot, whereas the payment and the compensation has stood still. So if Sweden is struggling to pay what it costs to live with these large carnivores, one might wonder, how are all these other countries going to pay? The truth is, unfortunately, that large carnivores are quite inconvenient to live with and very costly for a minority of people who carry most of the burden. And the question then is, how do we redistribute that burden on a societal level? And we can do that, and we do have the money for that, but we need to prioritize it.
Obviously, an alternative would be to lower the protected status for wolves across Europe. Is there an argument for that, in your opinion? And if so, what kind of effect would that have?
Conservation is a discipline that is tasked with fighting against extinction. And at some point, if you're successful, the animals will no longer be in need of conservation. Some would argue that that's the case with the wolf now, that we don't need to be worried about every single wolf surviving anymore because there are enough of them. So if the wolf is downlisted from strictly protected to protected, which is the distinction being discussed right now, the member states will still have to ensure that the wolf is in a favorable conservation status, meaning that they won't go extinct, essentially. But you might be able to do more in terms of culling or hunting and so on. But there's a lot of disagreement about that. If you look very locally, there are wolf populations that are endangered, right? If you zoom into Luxembourg, there will only be, you know, they will always be endangered in Luxembourg because there will only be a few of them, right? But if you zoom out to the European continent and see it as one big population, they're definitely not endangered anymore. Yeah, it depends on how you cut the cake, and it depends on how you feel about the wolf being managed or being culled or being killed, because there's a lot of people who feel in their hearts that killing a wolf is wrong and therefore that should not be allowed. But there's also a lot of people who feel that, you know, hunting is a very natural thing that we people have engaged with throughout our existence on this planet. But I think underneath it all is just a question of the heart, whether you feel that it's right or wrong and how many there should be.
Well, I want to hear about howling surveys. That's one thing we learned, but maybe that's for another interview because that sounds amazing.
Yeah. So you go out at particular times and you howl to the sky and see if somebody responds.
Wow. That is the best way of counting wolves.
That's somebody's job. I know people who do this and it can be quite awkward because, you know, you might be standing there howling to the sky and somebody passes by and it's a bit, you know... have to explain why you're standing there by your car and sounding like a wolf.
That is much more complicated than I thought it was going to be.
Wolves! Who knew that they were such an insanely complicated policy issue?
Yeah, Nice to have that nuanced perspective from Hannah.
Really nice. Thank you so much to Hannah for talking to us. I first found out about her research via the podcast of The Conversation, which, if you don't know it, it's a great website where academics work with journalists to make their work accessible for non-experts like Dominic and me. She was a guest on their podcast earlier this year. I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. What have you been enjoying this week?
This week, I finally started watching the HBO series The Regime.
Oh, yeah.
In which Kate Winslet plays a rather wacky dictator of a fictional Central European country. Honestly, it's dividing opinion amongst the critics and amongst our listeners. There was a nice debate about it on our Facebook Patreon page a few weeks back. Most people think it's like imperfect, but has some entertainment value in its absurdism. And it's quite intriguing looking behind the scenes and imagining what a dictator's life is like. Kate Winslet is, of course, absolutely amazing, as she is in everything that she's involved in. I think it's worth giving it a try for her, really, even if you don't quite get to the end of the series, which I have to admit I might not. I am, however, really enjoying some podcast episodes that were released to accompany it. They're on the podcast Cautionary Tales, which I've actually talked about in this segment before. The episodes were recommended to us by our listener, Willem. Thank you, Willem. And the first one is called Inside the Bizarre World of Dictators. It takes a look at the social science behind dictators using psychology and game theory. And there's quite a fascinating section about the prevalence of germophobia amongst dictators.
Ooh, that sounds great. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, it's really good. What have you been enjoying this week, Katie?
I'm actually going to borrow my recommendation from a listener this week. It's for a film that has been on my radar for months now that I've been dying to go and see, but it's not available for streaming yet. And mysteriously, I haven't been able to find much time to go to the cinema lately as a new parent. So I've given up waiting and I'm going to give this to you on the recommendation of Francesca instead. It is for the Italian film C'è ancora domani, or to give its English title, There's Still Tomorrow. And it is a beautiful, poignant film shot in black and white. It's set just after the end of the Second World War in Rome. And it's fair to say that this film has really struck a nerve in Italy since it came out late last year. It was directed by Paola Cortellesi, who also stars in it as Delia, a woman with a horribly abusive husband, who is determined to liberate herself. Francesca says, it's the movie that we never had in the Italian neorealism wave about the life of our grandmothers and mothers. It fills a gap in the collective conscience and memory with the point of view of women. She describes it as witty and moving. And this film has quickly become one of the most successful films in Italian history. I think it was actually the most watched film in Italian cinemas last year.
Wow.
And it has really struck a chord at a time when, you know, it's a historical film, but violence against women is a huge issue in the Italy of today. Around the time when the film first came out, there was a particularly high-profile femicide case. A 22-year-old student called Giulia Cecetin was murdered in November, and her ex-boyfriend is on trial. Thousands of people went to her funeral. There's been a really huge wave of anger over the killing of this young woman just before she was about to graduate. So it really feels like the film for this moment. And something else that Francesca points out that's really interesting about this film is that it was denied public funding because it was not considered at the time to be a film that would be of much public interest, which just goes to show like how wrong the people that make these decisions can be sometimes. Mm-hmm. Francesca says that she hopes it will make it to the Oscars. And given the way that the critics have responded to it, I think she might be right.
Yeah, it's a big hit across the whole of Europe at the moment. I really want to go and see it too.
Quick note, unless you speak Italian, you will probably be watching this film with subtitles in whatever other languages you speak. And this reminded me, actually, that I got a really nice email a couple of weeks ago about another Italian recommendation that I gave a while back for the novel Lost on Me by Veronica Raimo. David Stockings, who is a translator, quite rightly emailed in to point out that I should have given a shout out to Raimo's translator, because of course her work was a huge part of what made it possible for me to enjoy the original. So I just wanted to give a big belated shout out to Leila Ginesco, the wonderful translator who worked on the English version of that novel. And in the future, we will be sure to give full credit to the subtitlers and translators of things that we've enjoyed in translation.
Good point. time for a happy ending. This week, I want to cheer you all up with the news that in a pioneering bit of legislation, Belgium has given labour rights to sex workers.
Hmm.
Belgium became the first European country to decriminalise sex work in 2022. There are other countries like Greece and the Netherlands, for example, where it is legalised, but under certain conditions. But this labour rights bill is big. It means sex workers will be able to get access to pensions, health insurance benefits, and it also gives them employment protections like guaranteed working hours and wages. It also places limits on who can give contracts to sex workers. The bill should reduce sex trafficking because from now on, anyone with a conviction for human trafficking will not be able to employ a sex worker. Seems like a no-brainer, but now it's actually happening. And according to the reporting I've read, the Belgian sex worker unions are really happy with this new legislation. It answers all their demands. Amazing and cheering to hear of an example where sex worker unions are actually being listened to. So congratulations, Belgium.
That's great.
That's all we've got time for this week. The show was edited by Morgan Childs and Katie Lee, mixed and mastered by Wojciech Oleksiak, with jingles by the amazing Jim Barn and Mariska Martina. We're gearing up for the European elections and taking a week off next week to prepare some special episodes for the week after. But we'll be back in your feeds before you know it. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media. Where can they find us, Katie?
On Instagram, there's actually a pleasing video of a Hungarian, what was it, Dominic? Some kind of flute?
Double flute.
There's a wonderful video of a Hungarian flute on our Instagram page. Check it out at Europeans Podcast. We're also on Threads, Mastodon, Twitter, and Blue Sky.
Farewell.
Fins aviat.